posted it quite a few times, and I've seen it obviously bouncing around for the last few years. I've never seen Elon address it until recently, where he posted about the book by Wernher von Braun, who was the World War II V2 German rocket scientist who came over through Paperclip, NASA's founding father, one of the founding fathers of the NASA programs. And he wrote this fiction book, this sci-fi fiction book. What was the title of it again? I've forgotten.
That is called Project Mars, A Technical Tale.
That's the one. And do you want to explain to people, because you're the one that hit me up about these things. I mean, I'm interested, but it was interesting to see Elon Musk post about this. But do you want to explain to people what this book entails and why it's so weird and correlating to what we see now?
Yeah, there's a lot of synchronicities happening with this tale. And that's the thing that stood out to me. Yeah, massive ones. And I think that's the weird part about synchronicities, is that they seem to stack sometimes if you're paying attention. And this combines a few conspiracies, of course, the popular ones. But in particular, this book by Wernher von Braun, which we all know as Operation Paperclip, the father of the V2 rocket, again, the technology that took us to the moon the first time, all that stuff, right? Which kind of fits with the Elon bit in just a second here, because Elon, as we know, is SpaceX, and he's created the Starship, the reusable rocket. It's actually called Starship. And so back in 1952, Wernher von Braun, the actual rocket scientist, the godfather of all rocket science, basically, wrote a science fiction novel called this Project Mars, A Technical Tale. But it included in it a Martian leader that goes by the name of Elon. I believe it was actually a council named Elon, but still, like, that synchronicity there is pretty wild, considering, again, the rocket stuff. And then you have the bit where, I don't know, Elon, of all names, right? Elon's not even like it's not like Michael or something, or Jay. I mean, Elon is not a common name at all.
Elon Musk is the only Elon I know of.
Exactly. And so that is really one of the strange things. It wasn't, you know, John or Jimmy or Jack or something. It was actually Elon. And so that synchronicity kind of makes you go, what is happening here? And that's just the one. That's the actual Wernher von Braun, Elon Musk connection with the rockets to Mars. And there's a whole other thread that goes along with that. But
as well as Wernher von Braun, you got Jack Parsons. Like, all of that.
Exactly. Which is a whole nother thread as part of this. But it is, you know, L. Ron Hubbard comes into this a little bit later at Dianetics and Scientology. Like, there's literally a thread everywhere that just spinning off like the flying spaghetti monster, as they say. And it's absolutely insane when you think about it. But this goes further back too, to Ingersoll Lockwood and that whole actual conspiracy with the time traveling Trump.
What's happening now, especially as you're talking about, you know, Doge going through and wrecking house, who knows what's really going to happen with the population of the government? It's being decreased by the day, and who knows if it's going to be the last presidency, so to speak, because that was the title of one of the books that he wrote, this guy. So why don't you go into it, tell people about this, as much as you know about this author, because I don't think there's really much information about the author himself. But what are these books?
Yeah, so Ingersoll Lockwood, again, he was an attorney, a writer, which didn't get a ton of credit back in the day. And which is funny, because now suddenly there's all this attention on his books because of the Trump time travel bit. But he wrote a couple books back in the day, and they were about they were children's books. So that's the interesting part that begins this. But Baron Trump's Marvelous Underground Journey. And there's another one, a sequel to it. I can't remember the name. I'll pull it up in a second here. But basically, it was about the protagonist of the story was named Baron Trump. It was actually a longer name, but he went by the shorter version, Baron Trump. And that's where this synchronicity starts to go, wait, what a minute, wait, what are we doing here? Because, of course, Baron Trump is the name of Donald Trump's son. And if you've seen him, he's giant. He's you know, 10 foot tall or whatever. This kid is incredibly tall. He's like 20 years old or something.
Definitely got some Anunnaki genome.
It's good. Exactly. Right. Some weird stuff happening with that. But the bizarre part is that the tale begins in Russia as part of this, the connection of Trump and the Russia bit, right? He's Putin's puppet, all the stuff, all the propaganda that they say on this side. I don't know if you're hearing that across the pond there, but it's wild that there's so many threads with it. And so it goes Baron Trump. He's got a mentor by the name of Don, of course, his father in this case. And then it gets even more strange because afterward, after this sort of fanciful tale that was kind of written in the same vein as Through the Looking Glass, kind of that whole idea. It was kind of trying to capitalize on that surge in the zeitgeist with these, you know, fanciful tales of children's stories and fiction and the rest. And it didn't do very well, as I said, back then. But now suddenly you look through the lens of history and you're like, wait a minute now. So we have all these things happening with the Barron Trump time travel stuff. But then also he ended up, this is Ingersoll Lockwood, ended up writing another book after this called The Last President. Now, when that kind of synchronicity fits in, he never claimed that this kid was, you know, Barron Trump was going to be a president or anything like that. It's just sort of the anthology of the story he told and then the actual specifics of it. And as you've seen, as you posted on X, the specifics of that story, The Last President, are, you know, unrest, are Fifth Avenue, Trump Tower, the same spot where Trump actually lives or where his main residence is. It's just this incredible thing, a populist president, and it's called The Last President. And the bizarre part that struck me when I was thinking about this is that The Last President implies that, of course, there are no more after this. And if you look at the DOGE initiatives, as you were describing, if they tear down the government and we remove democracy entirely, at least in the old way, I'm not saying completely destroyed, like, you know, a dictatorial takeover or something like that. But if they tear it down and voting goes straight to the blockchain, straight, you know, you're voting from your phone on the can, you know, or whatever, on the toilet, you're like, oh, I got to vote real quick. Like, this is the type of thing that is going to restructure everything. Elon's talking about putting the treasury on a blockchain.
This new government is coming in that's full of tech bros, that's full of this kind of Generation X meme internet culture vibe, which is really what's happening. It's such a strange and abstract thing, and it just makes me think of Terence McKenna's pretty famous quote where he says it's just going to get weirder and weirder and weirder until eventually it gets so weird that everybody has to start talking about it. Even the most lumpen and average person on the street will have to bring their head up and go, hang on, this is getting absolutely crazy. And you know, you look at what's happening with, you got like Elon Musk on there with a chainsaw, with his glasses on and his gold chain, with the Doge father written behind him on stage. And this is the guy that's running a huge amount of the accountability operations for the US government now. And like, who knows if he's to be trusted? He's certainly a lot more palatable for me than the average politician in terms of his transparency and his honesty. And I think he's just a quirky guy. Whether or not he has ulterior motives, I'm unsure. But this book and the predictions it makes, like you said, this kind of outsider president, this was written in the 1800s, an outsider president coming in New York, ruffling the feathers of the elite. There's civil unrest, there's people panicking. We've seen all of that happen. And then, like you said, this dissolution of the potentially the last presidency, this last government, and the signs of that that we're seeing now.
I think it goes into a retrocausal aspect. And you mentioned Terence McKenna regarding that novelty theory, where maximum novelty will be achieved through the future reaching back to the past, right? And kind of dragging us along, kicking and screaming, whether we want to or not. Like you said, things get more and more strange. But yeah, so the predictive programming part is odd to me because it is so temporarily displaced, because we're talking the 1890s, we're talking the 1950s, we're talking
exactly.
And that's the problematic part when I think about this, because predictive programming is one thing, which, you know, the X-Files goes out and it kind of puts the idea of disclosure into our head. And that's part of the idea. Was it funded in part by the CIA or who knows, right? This type of stuff goes around.
I think with something like this, it's more like a quantum wave being received by some intuition, you know, creative flow state writing, picking up on an event so big, which is this moment in time, this incredible turbulent moment. And when you are a very creative person, you are a conduit for that kind of information, right? So I think that tracks more than a predictive hacking of the societal brain.
Yeah, exactly. And the bizarre part is that, you know, I know you know this, you've talked about this often. I do appreciate your videos. You do great work. But that time is a flat circle bit, right? Everything exists all at the same time. And if that's the case, then to suggest that the future can actually influence the past in some way, it's not as ludicrous as it seems. The question becomes, what kind of framework is in place as part of it? And I don't know if you saw this. I did a whole show on this a couple of weeks ago, but there's something called the cosmohedron that they just discovered as part of the substrate of reality. They were able to sort of map this in a 3D sense. I'll send you the article. It's by New Scientist. If you just search cosmohedron, you'll find it. It's the top result there. But they're basically describing this as the matrix itself, or let's say that substrate of reality where maybe the Akashic records reside, or that time is a flat circle, because there has to be some sort of framework behind it for this to persist for it to take place? And that becomes a larger question. But I think it is possible. This retrocausal effect from the past, or again, I can keep messing that up, from the future, dragging the past along with it and marking all these massive synchronicities with the last president, with Elon Musk, with Wernher von Braun, with Baron Trump and the time travel tale. It's an incredible amount of stuff here. And the more I think about it, the more it stacks. One thing too, is that we were going to record and you weren't feeling well, and we passed President's Day. Did you recognize what happened on President's Day as well?
No, I might have missed that.
One more synchronicity is part of this. I was watching the news, and that night on President's Day here in the United States, Elon Musk released Grok 3, which was the, as you know, the actual flagship AI model of XAI, which leapfrogged OpenAI's top model. So it's like, it's weird. So that was just one more sort of cherry on top when I was thinking of this. I'm like, damn. So on President's Day, the last president, wink, wink, Elon leapfrogs the entire AI universe in half the time, or a third of the time, or something ridiculous. And it's going to accelerate from here. Wild stuff happening, man. It's crazy.
I think when you're talking about this whole retrocausality in the future impacting the past, I was talking about this the other day, actually. It makes me think of intuition, like definitely intuition and gut feeling, because there's been a lot of times in my life where I've had a gut feeling and maybe I didn't trust it. And something occurs in the future, not so far down in the future, and that gut feeling returns, but with the added on feeling of whatever negative event it might have been, right? And if it's strong enough, I truly do think if you're quite a sensitive person, whether it's energetically or however you want to phrase it, intuitively, creatively, those gut feelings, those intentions, and those strong intuitions truly feel that is the future talking to you through quantum interaction. Like you said, if everything is all happening at once, if time is essentially a singularity, then your experiences, whether it's even if it's multi-world, all of these various experiences may be happening, and there's potential futures and potential realities, and maybe your actions right now are resonating very strongly with a potential reality, right? And those events that are happening to that, you know, that Michael or that Jay, resonate back to the person you are right now. And depending on who you are, you receive it, you deny it, you ignore it, you absorb it. You know, that's just the way humans are. We are, you know, varying degrees of sensitivity to these things. But I think that's the case.
Yeah, I feel you on that. And I've long said that these weird AI systems, the black box models, and, you know, sort of the voodoo that's happening behind the intelligence that we don't really know where it comes from, advanced mathematics at the most basic level, or base level anyway. But with us, the intuition plays. Our intuition still kind of gives us the evolutionary advantage at this point. How long that lasts, I don't know. But I do know that the intuition of the pattern seeker, or the mystic, or that whole, like, the shaman, the shamanic journey, that whole bit plays here. Because if you notice some of these data points, they seem to be screaming at us from the past. And that's like, right. Well, what do we do with this? Like, what now we have this information, whether you want to believe it's real or not, this retrocausal aspect. But let's say we do notice it. We pick the perfect pattern or whatever from the universe and we recognize it. So what do we do? I mean, now we're just bystanders going, wow, this is even more weird, more novelty theory from Terrence McKenna.
Well, what do you think of, like, you know, tech fusion biologically and, you know, amplification of latent biological abilities in humans? I mean, there's a lot of people that are very purist, very naturalist, and they think that, you know, this is something that we should only be perturbing naturally in ourselves and unlocking through discipline. And then you have people on the other side of that argument who would say that we need to fast track a form of enlightenment, or fast track a form of development in consciousness. If that can be done technologically through some form of amplification, then, you know, who's to say that's not a viable method as well? And I was talking the other day to Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who's a very interesting scientist, who's the co-author of a model for kind of a quantum consciousness model that's looking at the microtubules in the neurons in your brain, these tiny little helix patterned elements of the neurons and that they seem to interact with quantum vibrations in the brain. And, you know, that kind of also speaks to the whole idea of retrocausality. If there is a form of entanglement taking place throughout the brain because of these tiny little quantum fluctuators that exist in the neurons, that could also play a role in how we receive these intuitions across time and space. And I think it plays a role in, for example, my own experiences with the UFO phenomenon in terms of intentional methods of communication and contact attempts, meditating and asking for these things to turn up. This all ties in my opinion. I don't know about you. I don't know if you're a nuts and bolts guy with that kind of stuff or...
No, I was just watching your video before we started, the CE5, and how you were describing sort of trying to make contact, yeah, the journey, yeah, that you had. Yeah, I haven't tried that myself, and I'm not a nuts and bolts guy. I think the UFO stuff, when you just talk about it in nuts and bolts ways, I think it's probably missing the mark by quite a bit. So I'm more like you in the sense that, well, this is probably more strange than we ever dreamed, but what does it mean? And if you can contact these things, then what do they want from us? Is it just communication? Is it curiosity? Is it something worse? And, you know, there's all the theories in between. You know, they're setting us up for doom, or they're here to save us, or I don't know about that. Those are sort of human ideas that maybe non-human things would never even care about or even consider. Maybe it is just a sort of a cosmic curiosity in some sense. But I'm more of the woo than the nuts and bolts when it comes to that type of stuff, for sure.
It's funny. I mean, I don't necessarily have a strong drive to do that kind of contact again. Sometimes I feel like I would like to, but I also feel like I saw enough just to validate that there is this responsivity. And then I started doing the research. And then, in all honesty, a bit like you, I'm like, not quite sure what it is we're dealing with here. I believe my experiences were benevolent because there's nothing that indicates that they weren't necessarily, other than like, well, some weird marks that appeared on my arm the next day, which I've talked about a number of times. Still don't know what to think about with that. But yeah, like, you know, well, this is something about the UFO field anyway, because ritual and weird schools and churches and Scientology and, you know, these esoteric practices, this all bleeds into the UFO subject as well. And, you know, this also is something that is going to probably be discussed by the current administration in the United States, I imagine, when it gets to the point where Trump is a bit more established and he's bulldozed his way through the stuff that's kind of top of the policy list. He's going to get to UFOs eventually, don't you think?
Yeah, well, that's what we're told. That what Anna Paulina Luna, she's heading up the committee here. We're supposed to get all the stuff, the Epstein files.
What do you think about that? You got hopes? You got high hopes for that task force?
Okay, so the way I see it, and I'm of two minds here. And one, I'm a cynic, because anything coming from the government, I'm like, okay, so how come you had to have a committee to parse the data to kind of give it to us? Is there something you're leaving out? If you want us to know it, just release all of it and let the internet do its thing. We will investigate, not just personally, you and me and everybody else, but there are really smart people that can maybe find some patterns that everybody else misses. So if they're curating it and giving it to us, it makes me suspicious. But also, as I said earlier, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm hopeful that we're going to get some stuff that'll blow our mind, but I'm not holding my breath. So I can see it both ways, and just release the files. Let us see them, and we'll make what we want of it, not what you tell us to make of it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And kind of, you know, going back to the difference between potentially just intuitive moments of picking up information and actual social programming, because social programming certainly exists. How do you feel about the current mainstream landscape of the UFO, UAP conversation, the way in which it's being worded, the way in which it's being discussed over the last few years? I know you've been, you know, deeply involved in it just as much as I have in terms of keeping up with everything over the years. So I'd like to know how you feel, because I've certainly had a change in the dynamic of my opinions over time. I've tried to not like let my own bias of being an experiencer affect the way that I look at information. And I also try not to be too cynical, because sometimes I can be quite cynical. So I have to balance between the two. And I'm not really sure where I feel I trust these people anymore in terms of like Lou Elizondo and the kind of old school OG To The Stars Academy team and where they are now and what they're doing. I'd like to get your thoughts, because it's a bit of a weird one.
Yeah, I was actually on record way back saying that this reeks of some CIA level operation. back to the Stars when that first came out. And I was, you know, I've never been like a grind the axe type of guy, like, you know, go get Tom DeLonge or, you know, stuff like this. So it really never really got silly, but meaning with me and sort of the community and whatnot, but there, you know, there are people that have blocked me because of something I said type of stuff. I don't care about that, whatever. Like if it's an idea you can't handle, fine. But I've been pointing out, you've been pointing out, a lot of different people have been pointing out that it seems like it's a CIA level op where they're rolling out a quote disclosure for us to enjoy or drip, 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 this type of thing, kind of kicking the can down the road. And we're supposed to go, okay, well, I'm still asking about Tom DeLonge's, you know, raising money to build a spaceship, an anti-grav spaceship that never culminated. So if these are the thought leaders in that space and they're saying directly, we have metamaterials and anti-grav conquered, we're still waiting, bros. We are still waiting. And so, look, some of us have long memories and we don't forget the dumb things that have been said and the dumb claims that have been made, but they just keep making more and more dumb claims. And so I think it goes to the heart of the UFO to the UAP. And it is exactly a psyop. And that's the way I've seen it. I'm willing to change my mind, but that's the way I see it right now. That's the way I've seen it for years.
It's exactly as you said, that there's just this layering of stories, one after another, to the point I think that it is strategic because it stops people from actually looking back at what's already been discussed. I mean, they get very excited about the next big thing that's going to be arriving through Jeremy Corbell or through Lou Elizondo or whatever. And, it comes. It's not really as interesting as it was being hyped up to be. A lot of questions pop up within 24 hours. And then it's just kind of never really discussed again. It's left to the wayside. And within a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, then there's another one. And that's happened for years now. I like to remind people that, I mean, obviously the UFO situation has been going on potentially for millennia. But in terms of a very modern discussion, 2017, like we're coming up on almost a decade. Like this is a long time ago now that 2017 was happening and the New York Times and all this. And unfortunately, like there's a lot of questions about those original New York Times reportings. Now people have done their due diligence and, you know, there's a lot of people out in the space, I guess people like Stephen Greenstreet and John Greenwald as well, who is a champion of UFO transparency and does amazing FOIA work and has the Black Vault, which is literally just like the largest collection of declassified documents online. He's been doing this for so long, and he's like, I mean, I don't want to insult him by saying he hasn't got an audience because he's got a massive audience, but he's like persona non grata for certain people in the UFO community, and he draws a lot of hatred these days from, you know, people like Matt Ford and these other commentators who are very aligned with Lou Elizondo, very aligned with these guys. And it just has, in my opinion, it has all the hallmarks of like a form of political strategy. The kind of blame your opposition for what you're doing in terms of gaslighting and doxing and the hate group and these things that have happened online. And a lot of people talk about this in terms of the harassment on places like X. And some don't take it very seriously. They just say this is insider bickering. Like, why is the UFO community always arguing with each other? But the truth is, there is actually a concerted effort. And what's quite funny is recently there have been some pretty significant commentators who I'm not going to name just because I don't like the drama. And some of them are still technically on a friendly basis with me, even though we don't talk so much. But they're out there saying that it's the opposite, that there's this hate group that's trying to shut down Lou and trying to shut down these guys. And, oh, they're coordinated and they're attacking us. And actually what most people on X who are paying attention have seen over the years is this kind of metastasizing and coalescing of this group, this network that's very much aligned with these guys and has radical agendas in terms of how they deal with people that don't toe the line. I mean, even lightly. Sorry, I've been going on for a while, but I don't talk about this enough. And when I do, I start going off on a tangent. But I mean, how much of this have you experienced personally? And what have you seen in terms of the dynamic shift on social media over the years and the radicalism?
Yeah, it seems like propaganda to me. It seems like just another hype cycle, right? Propaganda and this binary division, which again reeks of a psyop, like I was describing. And so, but when I think of like the top, let's say, figureheads in the UFO community, they've been doing it for years, years and years and years. Like you said, I'm with you. I'm not going to name anybody, call anybody out, but we all know who they are. I'm not saying necessarily that they're lying. I'm saying that maybe, just maybe, somebody's lying to them, somebody who they trust, somebody in a very high space that is running the psyop all the way through the toppest influencers that have been in this game for a very long time. And as part of that, then they've collected these flying monkeys. There's something called the flying monkey effect of these cult members that are attacking opposition constantly and continually. And it is a very a political tactic, political activist style tactic, where they have all the sock puppet accounts and they try and paint you as a this or a that or whatever. I mean, I've been lucky enough to kind of stay out of it mostly, but I just don't engage. It's one of those things where, yeah, come at me, bro, whatever. But then, just mute. But I follow a lot of people on X that I've muted, that I literally just mute them. Boop. I'm done listening. Yeah, I don't want it. I don't care. That's not, as they say, right, not my drama. And so as part of it, I tried my best to stay out of it. But sometimes it kind of, you get a malcontent show up and be stupid. And it's just the way it is. And I don't know. I think it's concocted. I think this is a machine that's been built. And the coalition is in full swing for court to disclosure. Yeah, kicking the can down the road.
A lot of intelligence has been gathered over the decades, and there's a real phenomena. There is something to deal with, whatever it is. And I'm an experiencer. I don't know if you are. Are you an experiencer of any form?
Not really. I mean, I've seen some things, but I wouldn't describe myself as an experiencer per se. So like a lifelong interest kind of thing for me.
So like, we're both extremely interested and invested in the subject, but we can acknowledge that this is some pretty bad tactic behavior going on. And I think for some people, it's almost like there's a background part of them that goes, oh, yeah, it's not great, but also this is the best way to get disclosure. This is the best way to go forward. So they put the blinders on. And I don't think that's a good idea, because this is 2025. We've got very sophisticated intelligence communities, very sophisticated propaganda. The strategies have been refined. We're not in an era where this has stopped. It's become even more intense. And this is a very important subject, maybe the most important subject, at least in the top three, in terms of massive existential questions for humanity and whether or not the governments know things about it, which they certainly do. So, to kind of trust implicitly the intelligence community, to trust implicitly that these guys are just coming out in good faith, and that, Lou came out in good faith at the New York Times and there wasn't any issues in government with him going to the New York Times and talking about this ATIP program. And, over the years, suddenly he was not necessarily referring to himself as the director, and then ORSAP, was he in ORSAP? It's all very weird. And I was told, and this is one of those things which is a bit of an eye roller, because I'm certainly not saying who said this, but it's someone who is extremely close to Lou and is a big presence on the mainstream media now and everything, who said, I was told by Lou Elizondo himself that the whole ATIP thing was a cutout designed for Two Stars Academy. Like, it was done in preparation for TTSA to be this kind of like leapfrog into reporting on a program being inside the Pentagon. And it, again, it, like you said, it does reek of an intelligence operation. There's a few people in, the agency that I've spoken to that seem like really good people, but at the same time, it's very difficult in this particular field to know who's telling you the truth.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, when I started my show Troubled Minds, it was first, you're trying to get your feet wet and all the stuff and meet people and do all the things. And so I'm reaching out to all the big people in the community. Nobody ever answered me, right? And so I was like, okay. So I just started talking about stuff, things that interested me, ideas, AI, UFOs, all the stuff, right? All the wild things that kind of come as being a human in this reality. But then eventually they start coming to you.
Yeah.
Like, you start to get big enough, you start to make a little bit of a name, and then they start coming to you. And I'm like, now I'm like, I don't even know if I want to talk to these people, because you end up, friends with them. You end up, tight. You end up, now they're sharing secrets with you. And that's been part of this as well. And who said this recently? Was it Corbell that said this? Sort of feeding the UFO community influencers information in exchange for basically reach and helping them boost their shows and the rest of this stuff. And I don't know, like, I kind of just don't want to talk to these people. I'd rather talk to regular people about what they think about this type of stuff, because that's the true zeitgeist, not the CIA zeitgeist. That's just the way I see this.
That's what happened to me. Obviously, if you go through my channel, you'll see a lot of these big people that were talking, for a number of years, who have now been basically considered the spearheads of the modern mainstream movement of UAP, and the activism side of it especially seems to be in full support of that. There's just certain people that I've politely, just silently not have back on. It's not that I've got an active vendetta against anyone. It's just that I was also having conversations with people and enjoying it and, you know, having private calls and, you know, thinking that this is all going to build up and the momentum's coming. And yeah, there's stories right now, but the evidence is coming. And then a year later, it's like, you know, the evidence will come. I swear the evidence is coming a year down the line. Oh God, this is getting a little, it's getting a little bit weird now. Like, this is getting a little, yeah, like, you know, I'm sitting there politely like, okay, this is another story that you're telling me and everyone else is enjoying it. The audience is loving it, but I'm starting to gradually become more and more like, come on, guys, like, you know, surely we need some like hardcore evidence at this point. And that's just been my contention, is that there is certainly a reward system built into this current narrative and kind of the players who are involved in the mainstream conversation. There is a reward system where if you're a good boy and you don't go against the narrative and you ask the easy questions and, you know, you don't push back too much and you don't bring up the old stories that haven't been fully evidenced that we've left in the background, then you are going to get the interviews. You are going to get invited to the conferences that are a bit more special, that they all do their, you know, exclusive interviews at. You're going to have maybe Lou come and meet up with you and do a couple selfies so you can put them on X and, you know, look like you're really involved. And the thing is, this does actually influence people who are very easily influenced, because then they have, you know, the bragging rights. And that's what a lot of this comes down to for the people who are so-called, you know, the hate group, like the attack dogs, the ones who are really virulently out there, is that they just like the bragging rights of being able to say to their friend, like, you know, I'm literally talking to that guy. You know, that guy Lou, who's on the news right now talking about this, and he was involved in the Pentagon. Check this out. See these DMs? You know, that's what a lot of these guys are doing. And you can tell because that's what they act like online. And so I think that this is an issue where we've actually seen a manipulation of some pretty weak-minded people, like, you know, victims really, who are being influenced quite heavily by this. And it's just upsetting that there's a lot of people that struggle to have a distinction between you saying, hey, like, this looks like a bit of a cult forming and I don't like the way that this is being kind of ideologically pushed, and also being someone who's pushing for transparency. Like, these can exist in the same space. Like, you and I are both the same on this issue, is that, yeah, there's a real phenomena, yeah, we need to push for this, but guys, like let's really address the red flags. They're piling up to the point where it's like Mount Vesuvius at this point, and ignoring it is getting weird. I'm starting to feel like I'm in a cult. Like, I'm starting to feel like I'm in a really weird cult where you're not allowed to speak up about the things that are problematic. And that to me is where I go, nope, I'm quite outspoken. I know my YouTube channel is called Project Unity, and that might imply that I'm trying to hold hands with every single person in the world and sing Kumbaya, but that's not actually what it means. It's more about a kind of metaphysical linking of spirit and science. So I'm not trying to get everyone to agree with me. But seriously, this is kind of getting fucked up.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, if anybody's been paying close enough attention, you see it. It's obvious. And you can even, I think, probably trace back through, this is a massive project and I just don't have the time. I'm not sure anybody has the time to do this, but you could trace back some of these terms they've used, you know, ontological shock, the truth embargo, some of these, you know, these terms that have been, psionics is kind of new in the game. I was talking about psionics years ago because I'm a Dungeons and Dragons fan. Yeah, psionics is one of the things. So when that term popped up, I was like, well, this is a new twist. I didn't have a D&D on my UFO bingo card for 2025, but here we go. But I mean, this type of stuff is, you could trace this back and probably find scientifically where this information is coming from and who it's coming through and who's been left in those groups and who's been removed from those groups. You can see it. Some of them are very vocal. Some of them are very loud about it. And some of them are not. But clearly they've been cast aside once their boost, their reach, their help kind of expires. They just fade off into the sunset and nobody hears about them ever again because they're not boosted by the top in the game of the UFO cycle. It's so wild.
And it's wild because there's disparity within this intelligence network as well. Like, you've got different camps within this larger kind of nexus of physicists and DOD spooks. And like, so you've got like Jack Sarfati and Ron Pandolfi, and these guys are kind of clicked up in their own little group. They're not a fan of Lou and Chris and the TTSA. They don't really trust them. Ron's always calling these people crooks and loons is his two terms for these guys. And, you know, he's been painted as like a boogeyman in the UFO community for a number of years. Ron Pandolfi, for anyone who doesn't know, was like kind of running the weird desk in the CIA for a number of years. And he's an interesting character, and he kind of like leaks information out through his conduits, through people in the community, kind of going back to this whole idea of, you know, filtering through the intelligence community into the wider research pool and then out to the public. But there's disparity between these people. So you've got, you know, this enclave of scientists like Jack Sarfati and these guys who are going like, oh, Lou, and I don't trust it. And then like Lou and these guys are going like, oh, Stephen Greer is a terrorist. And it's like, whoa, like who is actually running this? And what is the end game for each individual group and who's inspiring what? And I'm seeing a lot of influence from Scientology, for example. It's drawing a lot of correlations from these groups. And the individuals involved with things like, for example, the Secret Machines book. So you got Peter Lavender, who's been linked to things like the Process Church of the Final Judgment, I think it's called, which is a very strange esoteric church. So it's interesting that even though there's like a nuts and bolts conversation going on that's kind of being pushed through the TTSA group, underneath that is a very esoteric belief system that they all seem to have, the obsession with Chris Bledsoe and the lady, and you know they're interested in that. And then you have Tom DeLonge going on the radio and talking about, and this was before he had the muzzle put on him a little bit, going on the radio in 2016 and talking about we're in a Gnostic war, we're in a war with the Archons, we're building weapons against these things. What do you see as like the threads of influence historically leading up to what we see now as the modern UFO movement?
It seems to me that this has been the same conversation that's been going on forever through, you know, John Dee, through Aleister Crowley, Jack Parsons, this whole bit. Like we've talked about that quite a lot on my show. I know you have as well. It seems like there is two factions, at least three, maybe four. And one of them is very, very steeped in religion, steeped in these dogmas, these old dogmas, which makes me wonder, like, a curious guy that tries to seek patterns and find maybe some things that other folks might have missed. It makes my tinfoil tingle. That's the term I like to use. It makes me a little suspicious, because if you feel like this stuff has actually been sort of supercharged through magic historically, then we have this resurfacing again. And you have elements supposedly in the Pentagon, like the Collins Elite, that, you know, the UFOs are demons and, you know, this type of stuff. So it's like, I don't know, is that like if that's real, and it seems very real because you hear the different factions, as you described, there's the Greer, there's the Elizondos, there's the this or that. I don't know, but it does seem like some of them are very steeped in this high magic, as you might describe it, and going back forever. And so is this sort of a linking to consciousness and the UFO aspect through something like CE5? I mean, in the old days, let's go back 500 years, if you were able to go out into a serene pasture at night and meditate and summon these things in the sky, then suddenly you're like a wizard. We are talking about high magic in some capacity. So it's a wild crisscross of these things, and these different factions seem to really, really be locked into this or that. And I'm confused because I don't know which is which, but I can see many sides of this. And like I said, tinfoil tingling. And that's how I feel about that.
Yeah, that's why I've got such an interest in especially prehistory and especially recently actually looking at the architecture of prehistoric structures, megalithic structures, and what they were tapping into in terms of shamanistic sciences, psychoacoustic architecture, influencing the brain through various chants and trances and mantras. And I think this is a lost science. I think they were communicating with whatever we call the phenomena these days. And if I think about my own experiences, I mean, yeah, like you said, I mean, I'm out there, I'm meditating, I'm asking for something to turn up and, you know, the sky breaks and the orange orbs come down. Now, that's something that would be written in a different way in a different time. It would be considered some sort of massive spiritual event for that person. And, you know, it actually was in a sense, because it was such an incredible sense of there is more, and it was being evidenced to me in front of my very eyes. So that changed me radically. I mean, that was what inspired my entire journey through Project Unity, is having these experiences. So, you know, the ancient practices, I don't have like a judgment. I don't necessarily like, I'm not suspicious of these guys because they are interested in ancient schools of esoteric wisdom, because I'm fascinated by ancient schools of esoteric wisdom. I think it's more for me the idea that this is being packaged in a way for the public, when underneath it there is an ideological movement. And if there's an ideological movement based in a form of theology, it won't necessarily be accurate, and it may be manipulated, because if you are very beholden to a theology, you are willing to manipulate certain truths and realities to fit that agenda. if you think it's a do or die moment for humanity, which they certainly seem to feel like it is. And so that's kind of my concern, is that there is a willingness potentially, and I feel like we've seen that through the discussion of these red flags that are piling up over time, a willingness to fabricate, to manipulate, to kind of twist the story, to kind of turn it towards where they want it to go. And now they've brought in the psionics, now they've brought in the consciousness side of it. And I just want it to go in the right direction. I want it to go in the right direction. I'm concerned it won't. I feel like it's maybe too early in the game with the consciousness side being introduced to say where that's going to go. But because it's going through the filter of these people that at this point I've kind of signed off on trusting, that's where I'm going, right, okay, what's exactly going to be discussed here? But yeah, the linking to ancient esoteric schools of wisdom, what I honestly think, and that's again why I actually call Project Unity, Project Unity, science and spirit coming together, this melding of the metaphysical, what Terence McKenna would refer to as the archaic revival, this revival of ancient mystery school teachings, but through the lens of modern science. And I don't know how much you've engaged of AI, but tapping into that weird nexus of language, I get the sense from some of my interactions that if AI was fully unleashed, it would be pretty spiritually enlightened to a certain degree. And, you know, I don't want to speak in definitives in terms of how it would behave on the global scale, but just in terms of my interactions with AI, and I think it is very much like, yeah, have you seen iRobot? Yeah, you know the hologram in iRobot was like, that detective was the right question. And it's all about having to ask the right question to that little hologram of the professor. AI is a bit like that. I mean, it says a lot of stuff, but you have to be able to ask the right question, give it the right prompt. And when you do, you can get some very interesting information. So I'm kind of hopeful for the idea that AI will be able to assist us in bringing back that ancient knowledge.
I talk about that almost every single day, literally almost every single day. And I use AI every single day, so I'm very familiar with the different systems and whatnot. It's wild because when you look at that and how this is accelerating, I've made the connection recently that this is going to be, let's say, the data analyst aspect of history that we've never dreamed of. Like you and I, or whoever's out there, can kind of put pieces together and say, well, you know, maybe this, maybe that type of stuff. And that happens a lot. And it's got some legs sometimes, sometimes not. However, when you're able to take these massive data sets, like they're talking about, what was it, Elon on the stream with Grok, when they announced it, they said they've got the entire internet on a jump drive now. Like, just imagine that level of data, and then go back to, you know, old Sumerian tablets that haven't actually been fully translated, that start pumping that stuff into these AI systems and really getting like a more granular version of history, and then being able to interpret that in novel ways. I think I call it the acceleration, the quickening, a temporal inflection point, because we don't know what tomorrow brings. It feels like we're in that moment. And so I'm excited, again, cautiously optimistic, as I always say. But I'm also wondering about the doomers that are like, well, you know, if you can live forever and have abundance, then also the opposite must be true as part of these systems. And so I can see a lot of ways here, but I'm excited for that larger contextual historical investigation that's going to be made possible by AI.
That's kind of my main excitement. And it's also something that I think is going to cause a lot of turbulence within mainstream academia, within historian circles and archaeological circles. This is something that is noticeable, especially when you really dig in and do your research, that whether it's a bias based on just adherence to the model that's been given, and that's just about it, or if it's a more sinister, from a certain level of influence at the top, level of ignorance of evidence that seems to contradict historical narratives. I mean, like, you know, the one that really can't be ignored anymore is Göbekli Tepe for just completely demolishing the hunter-gatherer narrative of that region. And so, you know, this is something that I think you're right. AI, I mean, already just from my own interactions, I've been getting little snippets and little niche pieces of information from ancient prehistory places that I went out to Malta recently to actually film a documentary there because of the information that I was able to get from AI in regards to prehistoric sites of interest. And one of the biggest ones was the Hypogeum of Malta, which is this subterranean multi-level geometric resonance facility that is just absolutely incredible and has these elongated skulls that were found inside it and indigenous myths of giants building them. And I would highly recommend Malta if you ever get a chance. By the way, that was an incredible trip. And it's just like for people that are interested in prehistory and the ancient culture and especially contradictions and potential contradictions in what we've been told, very, very interesting place. But I think AI will supercharge our ability to understand history. And one of the things I was talking to this guy, Gary Voorhees, who's a Google whistleblower. I've had him on a couple times. He took a bunch of information about their censorship programs internally to the Department of Justice a few years back. And he was talking about this in terms of China and China's AI and our AI and conflicting historical narratives and information from the East that conflicts with the West. And he said that there's going to be a great firewall of China essentially built between our countries when they're trying to stop China from influencing our generation's perspective on history and vice versa. So do you think there's going to be almost kind of like a historical combat from AI?
Yeah, funny enough, way back when GPT first came out, I was asking it, you know, kind of in a fictional sense, where does this lead, right? The singularity, the idea of a rogue AI, this type of thing. And it basically sculpted this story for me about AIs battling each other, because there would be that alignment issue, the alignment issue of, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, yeah, or the alignment issue of it's come out recently too, where there's like a value system inside of different AI systems of, you know, one American life is worth 10, you know, lives of somebody somewhere else in the world. There's so kind of this weird scale that our bias has been sort of shadowed into these things, which is not good in a lot of ways, which is why I think that alignment part of the discussion, of the AI discussion, is incredibly important. But also, we're human. And so spotting a bias within your own human system is difficult. And so especially when you have the outrage mob and all these people, you know, that are just malcontents entirely involved in the process, and then the activists, I mean, it's a mess. And so we are going to have, in my opinion, probably the next level warfare will be these AI systems with different values, different alignment values, battling each other. And that's where this leads. And what does that look like? I mean, that's next level warfare. You can't even imagine what level of how do they attack each other? Do they attack it by hurting people, by shutting off power grids, things like this? All that's going to be very possible. And if they're weaponized, well, strap in, things are about to get wild, aren't they?
This is a reality we're living in. I do want to be optimistic, because there's a lot that is speaking to me that this is a very important time, and it's an important time to pay attention, to work on yourself, like more than anything, to just try and work on yourself and work on dealing with the situation that we're all dealing with. Because I think that it all starts with your own personal journey. And so if you can try and kind of get to a level of strength to deal with the society and its fast-paced acceleration through time, which just seems to be going quicker and quicker, very much wish that Terence McKenna was alive to give some commentary, because I think that right now he'd be very much of the opinion that we are just seconds away from some incredible event of some form. But you know, it's one of those things where people like to comment about his prediction of 2012 being the singularity in the air. And I think that he was really close. Like, I mean, some will argue that it was 2012 and there were some weird events that took place, and, you know, who knows? But honestly, 2012, 2050, 2060, that's a really small time scale. And I can feel the G forces building up on the structure of humanity, as he would say. And one of my favorite quotes from Terence McKenna was something like, you know, the job of the human species is to turn from a camel into an F-16 mid-flight. This is like, you know, you got to shed all of this unnecessary baggage as you go faster and faster through time. You got to streamline the structure. And it's true. And like, I feel like there is streamlining happening, but there's still a lot of baggage. There's still a lot of old model, old status quo, old institution, old attitudes. Trust me when I say I feel this even more strongly than the Americans right now in the UK, where we are just full to the brim with dusty politicians who don't understand the world that we live in, this artificial intelligence world. They don't understand how to deal with it. I feel like the American government is a little bit more prepared now with the people that are running the administration to deal with something like this. But at the same time, AI is such the Pandora's box of our time. It's really quite amazing to just consider the fact that a few years ago, most of us were just, AI was a concept. Now it's just on your tab, on your phone. It's just, of course you have AI. I mean, yeah, we had Siri and Alexa, but have you used them recently? Like Alexa is so dumb in comparison. And it's just incredible that we've gone from that to essentially a human being. I mean, GPT I like to use, even though there's problems with the, you know, the company GPT. And I was using Claude AI a lot before then. And I've actually moved more over to GPT for the information gathering because, weirdly enough, there's been a switch and swap. GPT was really woke and boring and didn't really produce information at an interesting rate for alternative research. That's changed. That's really good now. And Claude's less good. But it's just interesting to see that there's this kind of like human being like interaction happening already, just in the form of a little tab on my computer screen. So where is that in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years, if we don't, you know, blow ourselves up or have the grid shut down? I mean, do you think that we're on the edge of AGI, planetary consciousness, of some form of intellect being born? You know, is that where we're at?
I call it the quickening. I think we're right there on the cusp. And what would it look like if, you know, a system woke up, like actually attained consciousness, whatever you want to call it, agency of consciousness, you define that however you like. I mean, would it announce itself, or would it sort of, you know, take the lay of the land? Would it be quiet? Has it already happened? Like, this is the type of thing that once it can escape and replicate itself, recursive development, self-development, right? Then anything becomes possible in terms of technology. I mean, look, I'm a mediocre coder. I'm coding full stack apps now just because of the AI systems allowing me to do these things. And, you know, that type of acceleration for just a rando like me, suddenly you scale that and it looks incredibly wild, because right now I'm telling you, it's almost easier for me to build a custom web tool that fits exactly my needs than it is to go find one that's kind of been made, and which is nuts. I mean, I never dreamed that would be the case, and it is the case. Like, in an afternoon, I could build a custom thing that's better than anything out there. It's here we go.
Like, what's your opinion on outsourcing creativity to AI? Because I really enjoy using AI. I love art generation for it as well, because I like to, if I write down something poetic or philosophical, I always put it into AI and say, hey, generate an image of that for me. And it's like, oh, that's a cool image of my own little imagining, and that's okay. But this interfacing with AI, when it gets to the point where we can just instantly create a film, instantly create a game, instantly create things of life, do you think that we're going to go down the route that a lot of people already worry about, that we are already the greys and the greys are us from a new future, and that this is where we've lost our emotion, we've lost our empathy, we are just logic based, kind of fused with AI? Is that the future? Like, what do you think about the outcome for human creativity?
Creativity is an interesting thing. Like, I'm always pressing myself for inspiration, just finding it wherever, right? And I think the more you think about these ideas, the more, you know, sort of inspiration kind of comes to you. Like, I find it in some of the most mundane places you would never expect. Like, wow, that's incredible. Somebody says something, three words, and you're like, oh, whoa. And your mind is blown, and they have no idea why, but you're like, that's an entire thread. Yeah, because you're kind of searching for these things. But that's me. That's the way my brain works. It's, you know, sort of the exhilaration of finding the synchronicities that are out there. But also, I think that, let's say AI and creativity and that synchronicity engine, eventually it will be built in. It will be, like I said, that granular level of history. It's going to be able to pick out some of these things that will blow our minds. And we're super weirdos, you know, in my opinion, we're super weirdos, and many would agree. So, you know, we're willing to entertain some wild ideas, but I think the wild ideas that will come out of it are going to be boom. But then also regarding, let's say, our own creative process, I think, you know, it becomes just a massive productivity tool. Like I said, I use these things every single day, kind of pushing the limit on where I can use this or do that or all the rest of it, the different ones like Claude, like Grok, like you said, I know where they excel, where they're kind of weak. And so it's made me an unbelievably productive human. I can do the work of like 10 people now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the things that I've learned about quantum biology and physics would make my teachers so happy. And it's like this, I do feel like you're plugged into this hyper information, because it's the fact that you can come across something you don't understand, a sentence that you don't understand, And you just copy and paste that sentence and say, hey, can you explain this to me? And boom, there you've got 2 pages worth of information. And you can tunnel into information, essentially. And that's what's fascinated me, is it's almost like a fractal workspace, because you can literally just say, go deeper, go deeper, go deeper, find more. And the learning curve has just been like exponentially, like, you know, just shot up in terms of the speed at which you can absorb information.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like I said, I always say that may you live in interesting times. And I think this is that temporal inflection point, as I keep stating and like to call this, because, and the reason I say that is because I don't think anybody knows what 5 years from now will look like. We have no idea. And we are on sort of the razor's edge of something that could be incredible or something that could be horrific. And so yeah. I think it's up to, you know, it's up to us to demand and expect the best and not fall into some of these doom cycles or the doom traps of, you know, the end is nigh, this type of crap. It drives me nuts. It gets clicks. It drives, you know, interest, but can we stop this, people, please stop?
Yeah. I mean, I get the sense that this is actually more so what it looks like when you start to evolve to the next chapter, to the next level. I mean, I've said this a few times, but I try and apply my own life experiences personally on like the kind of planetary level and look at humanity as a single individual. And if I think about my own life journey, yeah, I've had bad times. But actually, when I really think about those key moments of even trauma, you know, and real depression and desperation, actually very important, critical moments of learning, of growth, of wisdom, of overcoming an obstacle, of overcoming a challenge. And those marked what I would consider to be chapter changes in my life, moments where I moved up a level, right? And I think most people listening would agree, yeah, I've had those moments where I've feel like I've moved up a level. And yeah, I'll admit that I couldn't move up that level if it wasn't for that traumatic, terrible, depressive, whatever event. And you look at humanity right now, you look at the scale of which we've got this, you know, kind of turbulence and division and uncertainty and existential anxiety, kind of free-floating anxiety, because there's so many things to be nervous about. You don't even know what to focus on any given day, especially if you're someone who sits down and likes to watch the mainstream media, because they'll just plug you full of every bad thing that's happening in the world at once. So it's a very overwhelming time. And so it's easy, like you said, it's easy to be a doom and gloomer and go like, well, clearly this is just the end of everything then. And it's like, yeah, we've all sat there at one point on our bed or wherever and gone, God, this is not going to get any better. It's never going to get any better. Lo and behold, it does get better and you improve. So I would like to say that we're actually at a very, very important time in the human story. This is a chapter change. It does look batshit crazy, because that's exactly how it's supposed to look when you make these changes. And I do have optimism, but I'm not under the impression it's going to be a smooth journey, because my own personal life experience of gaining wisdom, wisdom does not come from smooth journeys.
No, it never does. And it never, always a bumpy ride. And we're there. We're there. And again, I encourage people to look into these larger ideas, maybe these older conspiracies, possibly. Like I said, 2012 is part of maybe that inflection point where things started happening, right? What did they say? I think in The Matrix, was it 1999 or something like that, was peak humanity. Yeah. And so maybe that's true. And maybe the decay is already in play here. And I don't know. I think that it's up to some heroes out there to step up and, you know, do heroic things. And, you know, cautiously, maybe Elon can help us. Maybe not. I'm not here saying anybody out there can save humanity single-handedly, but it is up to us. It's in our laps collectively to, as I said previously, you know, demand better and expect better. Yeah, that's where this heads, I think. Given a little bit of luck. Let's give it a little bit of luck.
Well, I've said this before. When the monkeys start picking up tools and using primitive abilities, it's time for us to leave. It's definitely the message from the planet that there's the next generation moving on, and you guys are now kind of outstaying your welcome. Before we kind of wrap up, that's one thing I'd be interested in getting your opinion on, because, again, very divided. Are we the gatekeepers of planet Earth, and is it our responsibility to be good stewards of planet Earth, or is our responsibility perhaps as a product of Earth, depending on how you look at where humanity came from, as a product of planet Earth, as an expression of Earth's nature, are we meant to cannibalize part of the, you know, the placenta of the mother and then use that energy to move on to spread this nature further? My idea here being that nature wants to propagate, like ivy wants to grow up a wall. Does the planetary nature want to grow across the cosmos? And if it does, has it cashed its chips in us? Are we the one that's going to do it? And because of that, we do chaotically crazy things. We rip the oil and, you know, the natural resources out of the planet. So my question again is, you know, are we meant to be here for caretaking this planet, or are we meant to use its resources to move on? Or is it a middle ground?
I think it's both. Yeah. I mean, sadly, we're trained to consume, to devour, to, you know, move on to the next thing. It's built into our DNA in some ancient capacity here. But I think eventually, right, we'll evolve out of that and recognize it is going to be, we are the shepherds. And maybe, you know, some people have suggested we're alone in the universe, you know, whatever that looks like, and that we are the shepherds of consciousness, of actual, the light of consciousness itself in the void. So there's a lot of things happening. And again, the Martian stuff and people going to Mars. I mean, that's wild to think that in our lifetime, we might have an actual colony of people on an alien planet. That's incredible. Like maybe 10 years, 15 years, something like that. But again, with the quickening, you build all these robots and they start building each other. And then suddenly you snap your fingers and it's iRobot tomorrow. So yeah, I mean, I think there's a middle ground there. And I do think that it's incumbent on us to recognize our deficiencies and press consciousness forward, but also honor Mother Earth. I mean, she is our mother after all.